Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Relentless Fury by Ralph Kern, narrated by Jeffrey Kafer. Chapter 1. Major Korla, The Talos Rift, Starbase Appune. Staccato flashes of explosions and streamers of weapons fire erupted as the battle raged on and around the metal-clad surface of the asteroid, which was Starbase Appune. Not that Major Gan Korla had time to admire the light show as he drove his stick over to the right. The muscular, powerful S-91 wolf fighter responded eagerly. The black tip of its nose met the flank of the last remaining Kingdom destroyer, and he squeezed the trigger. His fighter vibrated as its powerful twin-pulse cannons opened up, stitching lines of blue fire across the flank of the vessel's already brutally damaged hull. The round slammed into the ship, leaving a gouging trail of destruction and a web of azure lightning as the destroyer's already tortured dispersion fields desperately sought to redirect the massive amounts of energy. They failed. Something blew inside the hull, opening a rent in the ship's once-proud visage. A billowing cloud of gas erupted from the hole, and Korla gave a thin smile of satisfaction. Tiny writhing figures of Kingdom spacers. He felt no sympathy for the dying enemy. They had been given every opportunity to side with the Neo-Hegemony, to become part of the glorious new coalition redefining the galaxy. Their government had declined, and now they would receive no mercy. The 300-meter-long destroyer began to roll, streaming gas and debris as it descended lazily to the structure-encrusted planetoid below. Seconds later, it plowed through the buildings, modules, and industrial units barnacled on the gray surface, leaving a furrow of destruction. "Destroyer is down," he called tersely. He flashed over the landscape, looking for more targets of opportunity. The jump mechs and breaching pods had slammed into the surface an hour ago, and the fighting had been fierce since. Most of the weapon emplacements had gone now, thank Father Terra. They'd caused the ignoble end of four of Korla's squadron. Men and women, without his skill, maybe, but the Hegemony would sorely miss their services. Still, the battle was nearly won. It was only Kingdom's stubbornness keeping the fighting going. The squat cylinders of dozens of breaching pods had disgorged thousands of troops into the base. The sad remnants of the enemy fleet was even now routing from the system, likely totally fleeing the Talos Rift, and would be headed home with their tails between their legs. Only a rear guard had remained, a few men and women in the base. Yet with the destruction of the destroyer, they now had no way off, no way to escape. If they had a shred of dignity to them, they'd be wrecking as much critical equipment as they could. Undoubtedly, the reason they'd been left behind in the first place. Not that it would make a difference to the Hegemony. Their engineers were ready to come in and set up everything they needed to turn Appune into a stronghold within days. "All ships, all mechs," General Horgan's voice rang out clearly over the comm. "We have received a surrender from the remaining Kingdom leadership. All units are to go to self-defense authority only." Cordula's lips curled in a sneer. Cowardly bastards. They should be fighting to the last man, woman, or child, like a Neo would. Instead, they were throwing themselves prostrate on the floor. He flicked his thumb over his stick, activating the safeties for his vicious weapons. As much as his instincts were to keep fighting, to keep firing, to keep punishing the filthy Kingdom forces, he was also a good member of the Neo Party. Defying orders was for lesser men and women. And his sneer softened, as for the senior officers who had surrendered, they would soon be enjoying the hospitality of the executors who would undoubtedly have questions for them. Questions which would be asked in their special facilities, with answers extracted in an agonizing manner. Actually, he mused with icy consideration, death would have been the easy option for them. He gave a dry chuckle as he pulled up. He began circling over the crater-strewn surface of Starbase Appune, keeping a watchful eye for any enemy which might want to try a suicidal counterattack. The conquest of the Talos Rift was nearly complete. Only one last Kingdom redoubt remained, and when that was taken, then the vicious battles for the sphere would be as good as over. The supply lines would finally be open, giving them a route between the Arcadian sector and the inhospitable expanse of the Dyson Sphere lying in the Ishtar system, and the limitless bounty of HE-3 contained within. And that fuel, that lifeblood for the Hegemony war machine, would be used to end this bloody conflict once and for all. Chapter 2 Admiral Darrow, New Avalon, The War Rooms.
Appune has fallen.
The words had overcome the rage and frustration which choked his throat. Now is not the time to let raw emotion get in the way of icy professionalism. And that was what Admiral Jonathan Darrow considered himself, a consummate professional. He looked around the war cabinet, his eyes finally locking on the Prime Minister, and braced himself for the woman's inevitable fury. It never came. Lattimore nodded and spoke calmly, quelling the burble of chatter which rose in volume from around the ancient oak table.
Thank you for your report, Admiral.
The war had turned into a grim meat grinder of lives, ships, and fighters, on both sides. Yet the bombing raids striking the worlds of the kingdom, so obviously designed to sap the citizens' morale, instead bolstered it. And thanks to the deal cut with the Federation, every destroyer lost in the Reach or the Talos Rift was being replaced. Equilibrium of the most brutal kind. A balance. The scales weighed by lives, ships, and aerospace craft on both sides, neither side managing to gain the advantage over the other. Until now. Starbase Appune was critical to the war effort, one of only two kingdom bases in the Talos Rift, an area of space wedged between the Arcadian sector and the Sphere. Each had the ability to launch strikes at the hegemony supply lines, but with Appune gone, the other, Velestra, was now alone and vulnerable.
What is the current status of Starbase Velestra?
Darrow shifted in his seat, settling forward and clasping his hands. He knew that each and every cabinet member would be seeking to divine meaning from his body language. Cold and calculated was how he needed to play this.
"Critical, Madam Prime Minister," he said, forcing an ironic confidence into his words. "Fuel for their ships, reactors, and fighters stationed there is depleted. Even supplies are dangerously low. I am informed that the personnel at the base are on half the calories they should be, in an effort to eke out their food for a little while longer."
"Velestra has no practical value," a voice drawled. Darrow fought from snarling at the man who spoke up. Horace Roth Myers, a man so highbrow he didn't speak as much as slur through his own entitlement. Yet despite the soft, well-articulated voice, his views were so extreme, he made the average Neo look like a bleeding-heart liberal. The Member of Parliament for Adrian wasn't even a part of the cabinet. Instead, he'd wormed his way in as a special advisor. Rumors, unsubstantiated of course, were that he was a war profiteer with investments in many of the most preeminent arms companies in the kingdom. For him, war wasn't lives shattered and worlds conquered. It was the bottom line in an accounting report.
"Perhaps allowing the base to fall will allow us to refocus our efforts on fronts of interest to us."
"You'd like that." There was no doubt Roth Myers was in the camp which believed the kingdom would hold, and during that time his profits would grow. Yet he managed to balance on that particular thin line by not appearing to be too pro-war. Seemingly, he was content with merely administering a gentle drip of poison to influence events for his own financial gain.
"And perhaps fronts of interest to us,"
Darrow responded, lacing diplomacy into his voice, "including maintaining a presence in the Talos Rift, especially a base within striking range of the hegemony homeworlds, not to mention providing a base of operation close to the Sphere."
"Perhaps,"
Roth Myers purred, wafting a hand dismissively.
"Yet it concerns me that—"
"What concerns me," Lattimore interjected sharply, "is ceding more ground to those hegemony bastards, and that is beyond mere strategic considerations. We ask our citizens to be strong. Lost Earth, I dread to think how much money we give to PR companies for propaganda purposes. Yet should we start abandoning more and more of them to their fates, sooner or later their fighting spirit will abandon them."
"Very good," Roth Myers nodded sagely. "But perhaps the Admiral would like to tell us just how he would seek to provide Velestra the support it so sorely needs. Then," he gestured around the table, "the government can decide if it is practicable."
Lattimore turned in her chair slightly, angling her body to exclude the odious man from conversation. Roth Myers was no fool. He knew what she was doing and merely responded with a condescending smile.
"And what would you need, Jonathan?"
He paused, the cogs whirring behind his eyes.
If he asked for too much, the cabinet would simply shrug and side with Rothmeyer's. What Vlestra needs most critically is fuel, food, and fighters. That means we'll need a convoy. Convoys passing through the rift come under relentless assault. Rothmeyer's raised his lazy voice and volume to emphasize the relentless. Which is why, Darrow spoke loudly, cutting off the man, the convoy would need adequate protection to get through. And even then you would be unable to guarantee their safety. There are no guarantees in war, Horace. Darrow fought down the urge to snap the response back to him, satisfying himself with a condescending smile of his own. Enough. Lattimore held a hand up, obviously tired of the interplay. Jonathan, put together a plan for me. I will review it, and if I like what I see, I will approve it. Madam, the resources we're talking about are... I will not cede kingdom territory, Horace. Being a patriot and whatnot... Lattimore stood, her chair rocking back. I'm sure you understand. Thank you, everyone. We will reconvene in 24 hours. Jonathan, my office, if you please.
Why the hell do you keep that arse around?
I didn't call you here for gossip. Lattimore raised her eyebrow as she lowered herself onto her office chair. It's unbecoming of a prime minister. Darrow paused as he made to sit. It was a common game she played. Just let them know she was in charge with a subtle piece of chastisement, a tactic which decreased in efficacy every time she used it. But, she continued, he has powerful friends and commands a good portion of Parliament. I give him the occasional tidbit, like a special advisor role. He swells with pride and carries them with him. Darrow felt unconvinced. Besides, and most importantly, he is a good morality check. Lattimore smiled, genuinely this time, as she gestured for him to continue sitting. If he says something is a good idea, there's a very high chance it's a load of amoral bullshit. She waved her hand dismissively. Anyway, that's just politics, and that's my job. I worked very hard to keep you apart from that, so you can focus on winning this bloody war. Speaking of which, despite my fine words, would giving up Vlestra be so bad?
You've been listening to Horace too much. Darrow leaned back. We lose Vlestra, we may as well give up on the sphere. We give up on the sphere, their hegemony gets access to an exploitable fuel source. For now, it's one of the few edges we have over them. Within a year, their HE3 production would beat ours. Within 3, it would rival the Federation. Within 4, after some time in the Executor's dungeons, you'd be hanging by the neck from rafters of the Winter Palace.
Something I very much hope to avoid, Lattimore said dryly.
Vlestra helps us keep the pressure on, Darrow continued. We can attack their convoys, bring in fuel from their segments of the sphere, and support our own forces in that hellhole.
You've won me. I'm just reality checking.
Lattimore drummed her fingers on the varnished wooden desk in consideration. What's it going to take to get through the rift?
We'll need enough transports to make it worth it, and we need to understand we'll lose a lot of them.
Lattimore blinked slowly, her own calculation going on behind her eyes.
And an escort commensurate with that, I presume?
Great minds think alike.
Darrow smiled. But yes, if we want to get them through, then we'd need a considerable portion of the fleet.
And it needs to be within a month.
After a month, the Galt can just walk in and take the place anyway. Our conversation would be irrelevant.
Lattimore leaned back in her chair, staring up the unclad, armored ceiling of her war room office.
Make your plans, Jonathan, she sighed, coming to a decision. I'll approve them.
Chapter 3 Captain Draper, Enris System, KSS Ghost. The red-lit bridge was cramped, sharing as many characteristics of a transport's cockpit as those of a naval vessel. There were only a few places where one could even stand up straight amid the clusters of equipment and blinking instrumentation, encrusting even the overhead spaces. Not a single inch of the stealth's cabin went to waste. Lieutenant Commander Nisha Draper, captain of Ghost, watched the target on the plot with calm, cold intent from her command seat, as if she were a lion sighting a gazelle on the savannas of Lost Earth. The Iconian freighter cruised on, unaware that she was being stalked by a tiny lethal vessel, the Kingdom Stealth Ghost.
Her engines are burning hard for her size,
Tommy Grimes, the sensor system's petty officer, huddled over his console, staring with fierce intensity at the readings of the ship they'd spent the past day stalking.
"Well, I reckon she's carrying a full load, Skipper.
So we have us a fat wallowing pig here."
Draper didn't take her eyes from the plot. A good sensor officer could divine unbelievable amounts of information from the passive devices a stealth primarily used to hunt, and Grimes was assuredly one of the best. He would patiently parse the scant scraps of data which came in, taking his time, slotting those hints of information into place as if it were a jigsaw which would form a picture. Still, it took even him time to piece it all together and to tell her exactly what they were hunting.
"Why, Skipper?"
Grimes nodded, the sweat glistening on his brow from the poor climate control of the stealth.
"She could be a good solid million to add to the tonnage."
Draper leaned back in her chair. The freighter's single escorting destroyer was on her far side, poorly positioned to intercept Ghost. They could put a torpedo into the freighter and disappear before the tin can could even consider taking revenge. She rapidly processed it, working through a mental flowchart. For a stealth to attack was always a risk, and it was her job to balance that against opportunity. And even if it was a viable hit, they only carried 10 of the bulky ship-killer torpedoes aboard. Valestra was running damn short of them. She had to know her prey was worth it. The million-ton estimate helped with that consideration. Whatever the bloated thing was hauling, it contained a lot of it, and the only things which move these days was cargo vital for the war effort.
"We're going for it,"
she snapped, her decision made and the time for procrastination over. Grimes grinned hungrily in response. Over the next hour, the stealth sneaked closer. So close that if they had a window on the tiny vessel, which they didn't, they could have looked down and seen their quarry with the naked eye. Draper pressed a button on her chair's armrest. With the whir of servos, the attack array rotated down from the ceiling, replacing her more general consoles with those needed to prosecute the attack without distraction. "Ready tubes 1 and 3, she murmured, trusting her bridge crew would hear and obey her command. The display before her zoomed in on the heavy freighter. She wasn't an elegant design, more like a long truss with a bridge and crew compartment at one end, and blazing engines at the other. Storage modules and tanks were fastened along the truss, seemingly haphazardly. In large, amateurish lettering, the ship's name was emblazoned on her side. Clara. An isolated part of consciousness vaguely wondered who Clara was. The captain's wife? His daughter? Mistress? A dog? She frowned, disregarding the thought. It was irrelevant. Personifying the people she was going to kill was the road to madness, a road she wasn't going to take. Her practiced eye swept over Claire, looking for the impact points which would cause the most damage. She could break its back with one torpedo. Putting one in the engines, too, would guarantee a kill. Maybe if they got lucky, or if the ship was poorly maintained, even spark off a reactor overload. That would save the cargo from any hope of being salvaged. That would be mission accomplished. She flicked her eyes to the tactical display. The destroyer was still beyond the freighter, relative to their position. As they'd closed on their prey, Draper had ensured she'd kept Ghost in opposition to the sleek Iconian vessel. Now was the time to strike. Modern combat jammers could spoof missile and torpedo AI with incredible efficiency, but a stealth's torpedo worked in a different way. They were more dumbfire weapons, not vulnerable to such countermeasures, and now was the moment of maximum vulnerability for the freighter. She laid a cursor on both points she wanted to hit, the engines and halfway down the truss. A pair of targeting lasers lanced out, painting the ships. Some modern warships, hell, even a few merchantmen now, covered their hulls in sensors to detect the lasers. Often that would be their first and only warning as stealth was hunting them. Clara was clearly as shoddy and old as she looked. Her engines didn't flare in response to being targeted. She didn't begin a wild attempt to evade Ghost, and most tellingly, her escorting destroyer didn't respond one iota. They had a clear shot. She flicked her thumb on the fire control, raising the safety. A clunk resonated through the ship as two external torpedo tube doors slid open. Draper smiled thinly. This was as textbook as it got, and there was no reason to delay anymore. There was no need for melodrama. Her voice was clear and as cool as if she were ordering a coffee. Fire 1, fire 3. Loud thuds echoed through the 200-meter-long, midnight-black frame of Ghost as the torpedoes launched. On her tactical display, the two blinking icons raced forward. A beeping noise increased in frequency as they closed on the enemy ship. Too late, Claire responded, much too late. Draper's smile turned into a wolfish grin of a predator who knew they had caught their prey. Claire's and her escorting destroyer's engines flared as they tried in vain to accelerate and evade. Seconds later, an explosion blossomed on the side of the freighter. The two ends began folding in together as the spluttering flame of her drive pushed the stern past the dismembered bow. Then the second torpedo slammed into the engine module. The effect was catastrophic. In an instant, the space where the ship had once been was transformed into a flaming maelstrom of devastation as the ship's reactor breached. Another million tons of cargo was not going to the regime or its coalition ally, the hegemony. A loud bong noise filled the bridge, the gong-like audio telltales that they were being hit by a sensor blast, presumably from the destroyer. On the tactical, more rippling echoes came from the warship, which powered up and over the dispersing remains of the Clara, as if she were a sprinter hurtling a frame. Now it was Ghost's turn to be hunted. Draper's practiced eye warily watched the destroyer. Her vector was just offset by enough of an angle to tell her the enemy ship hadn't picked them up. If it had, it'd be coming dead at them, saturating the space around Ghost with pulse fire until she took a hit. And just one could kill the vulnerable ship. "Secure for repositioning," Draper called. She'd already had the route out planned in the back of her mind. "Heading 129 by 048, a half-G under silent running."
"Half-G, silent running, aye."
The helm and executive officer, Lieutenant Nick Hargreaves, called. From 200 meters behind her, the hum of the engines grew to a rumble. The thin line showing Ghost's trajectory stretched out from her position, reaching below the destroyer, keeping the still-expanding cloud of debris of Clara between them. Ripples continued washing from the destroyer as it sought to find them with its powerful stealth-hunting sensors. Draper was no amateur, though. She kept the wreckage between them, letting the blooming bubbles of wreckage and destruction, which was the corpse of the freighter, shield her. The two ships pirouetted around that central point, slowly growing farther and farther away from each other. Soon the destroyer would give up and return to the remains of Clara, to see if any life pods had survived the destruction. It was odd, Draper thought, as she shut down the tactical. The array folded itself up and receded back into the deckhead above. How little she felt at the undoubted deaths of dozens or more people. There was a time not so long ago when witnessing the kind of destruction she had just wrought would have kept her awake for days. Not any longer. She didn't hate her enemy, not at all. Instead, she knew she'd become hardened and cold. Sympathy for the defenseless foe she had just mercilessly cut down could wait until after the war was won. Lieutenant Commander Nisha Draper was 26 years old, and entrusted with one of His Majesty's stealths and the lives of the 31 men and women aboard her. And that, to be blunt, was the one and only thing she did care about. Chapter 4 Flight Lieutenant Rick Richards, Regis System, KSS Corvus.
"Looking good, ma'am,"
Flight Lieutenant Jason Rick Richards murmured quietly to the pilot in front of him. Lieutenant Commander Rose Faraday pulled her gloved hand back, easing the throttle down. The rumble of engines from behind the cockpit of the two-seater training Tempest reduced in power as they swung around behind the stern of the carrier Corvus. The perspective of the huge vessel changed, the ship twisting from an elongated cylinder with a flight deck threaded through the center to a circle bisected by a rectangle surrounded by the welcoming, flashing illumination of the landing lights. He felt a buffet as they passed through the wash of her two engine nacelles, throttled down to steerage way lest they atomize the tiny fighter. The woman was good, for Navy that was, Rick thought. She'd been wasted on the Cyclone torpedo bombers. Those old kites were more a test of nerves than piloting skills, her previous job being pretty much to ignore enemy flak and anti-aerospace fire, keeping straight and level, and deliver a torpedo into an enemy warship. The rear of Corvus's hangar bay expanded. Within, rows of fighters and bombers were visible, lining the central runway threading through the center of the ship.
"Remember, we're a little lighter than a cyclone."
Rick casually lay his hands on the controls, just in case the Navy pilot was going to do anything crazy as they came into the traps. Carrier landings had long been considered one of the trickier maneuvers in flying.
"The buff of field would be more violent."
"I got it." They swept toward the bay, slamming through the rear atmosphere force field, sending ripples of energy around them. The first buffer caught them, and Rick felt himself being jammed violently forward into his harness, reducing their velocity from a relative 100 meters per second to 50. Then they hit the second field, halving their velocity again. The retros on the front of the fighter burned, killing off the rest of their velocity. Smoothly, the Tempest sank to the deck. Not bad. Not bad at all.
Okay, how do you think that went?
Rick asked, tugging his musty helmet from his head and setting it in his lap.
I think... okay.
Faraday flicked switches, powering down the fighter. Again, Rick nodded in approval. The woman had enough of what the pilots called spare capacity to be able to hold a conversation and do a technical task like shutting down her bird at the same time. Kicking myself, I needed a second volley in the target drone. Rick pulled his gloves off and smiled. If he was honest, Faraday was much better than okay. As much as he wouldn't admit it out loud, these naval aerospace arm pilots were damn good. Maybe not a match for Viper Squadron, but they certainly weren't as horrendous as he'd expected them to be when he took this job. After months of intense combat over New Avalon and dangerous reconnaissance missions, Rick had found himself being rotated back into training, ostensibly to cascade the skills and drills he'd acquired through hard and bitter experience down to the new pilots graduating from flight school. That's what his boss had initially told him, anyway. When he'd railed against the posting, the boss had ordered he sit his arse down and told him in no uncertain words that he needed a rotation away from the lines before exhaustion killed him. A month into his posting at Holefield, the Kingdom Aerospace Forces Training School, he'd been climbing the walls when an opportunity had come up. He was one of the most experienced Tempest pilots in the KAF, and the Navy wanted help training up pilots for their brand new carrier variant. So now he was attached to the 825th Naval Aerospace Squadron as their chief flying instructor, having spent 2 weeks on the Naval Conversion Course, principally learning just how fun carrier work was.
Yeah, from what I saw, you simply overcompensated. People get surprised by how smooth the Tempest flies. They think they've got to be firmer with them than they have to be.
Rick patted the console in front of him.
But just to kill the anticipation, I'm passing your check ride, ma'am. You're now a fully-fledged real pilot.
Faraday gave a scoff of laughter as she pressed a button. The cockpit slid open and a waiting technician grabbed her outstretched hand and hauled her out of the cockpit.
I'd like to think I was a fully-fledged pilot while you were still a twinkle in your daddy's eye.
It was Rick's turn to let out a laugh as he climbed down the metal stairs abutting the side of the fighter. This was a young person's war. Rick was 24 years old, standard. Faraday, at most, was pushing 30, if he was being ungenerous. Together, they crossed the bustling flight deck, stepping aside to allow a taxing Tempest to rumble past.
Are you settling in okay?
She asked. Rick rolled his eyes, thinking of the metal shoebox-sized cabin, which was now his home.
It's a little basic aboard.
You KAF types don't know what real luxury is.
Sure we do. An apartment on base and a mess with the beer flows like water.
Reaching a hatch, they slipped from the expansive flight deck to the claustrophobic worn of corridors and made their way to Faraday's office.
Not thinking of transferring your commission yet, then?
Faraday asked as she took a seat behind her desk. Rick gave a deprecating shrug. Frankly, the thought of being stuck permanently on a carrier held little appeal. What he really wanted was a rotation back to Viper Squadron. Failing that, any combat position in the KAF. The truth of the matter at the moment was that, short of hunting down that big bastard ship behemoth, the NAA, the Naval Aerospace Arm, wasn't getting the same opportunities to get stuck into the fight as the KAF.
Perhaps, he settled on.
He didn't want to insult his hosts, beyond friendly inter-service rivalry, after all. He reached into his thigh pocket for his tablet and unfolded it.
But that's for tomorrow. Right now, we have the fun stuff.
Admin.
Faraday drew her chair close to the desk.
Admin.
Rick nodded and began tapping in his tablet.
Right, the takeoff was nice, but I have to grade you a B on it for the wobble coming off the catapult. And for how to overcome that is...
And with that, they settled into a debrief of every aspect of their check flight. Chapter 5 Captain Cutter, Starbase Victory. Achilles bore her scars as she should, like a proud warrior. From the fires of battle over Asteria to the brutal slugfest with Behemoth, every pitted crater in her armor, every gash in her hull told a story of heroism and victory. At least that's what he should be thinking. Hal Cutter frowned as he looked over his ship from the observation lounge overlooking her slip. Instead, to him, those scars spoke of the sacrifice of spacers. those who had served on Achilles herself, those who served in the fleet, and those civilians who had answered the call. He quelled those thoughts. Now wasn't the time to dwell. Apparently, even in the midst of this...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?